Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Black-eyed peas are a New Year's staple throughout the South, but in Charleston, they're cooked into a special dish called Hoppin' John. That's also the name that cookbook author and educator John Martin Taylor is known by. Hoppin' John joins us to talk low country cooking, and then we explore what elements of food can be legally patented with Seattle-based patent attorney Paul Swanson. Whether or not you've enjoyed your 2013 Black Eyed Peas and Greens yet, get ready for a big serving of luck and money on this week's Louisiana Eats. If you are a fan of shrimp and grits, then you owe a big thank you to Hoppin' John Martin Taylor. 20 years ago, Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking introduced the world to recipes and ruminations from Charleston and the Carolina Coastal Plain. Hoppin' John, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Poppy, it's so great to be back in New Orleans. You know I love it here, and it's always a pleasure to be in your company.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning. What inspired you to actually write this book in the first place?
Well, I interviewed Karen Hess on the history of Thanksgiving. And Karen Hess, you know, many of your listeners may not know, but she's basically the grandmother of culinary history. Shortly before interviewing her, I was vacationing in Newport, Rhode Island, where Charlestonians had vacationed for 300 years. And there was a big pile of the belongings, it looked like, of someone's attic on the sidewalk. And on top of this pile of trash, calling my name, was a handmade book with a hand-sewn cover with actual photographs of plantations glued in there. And on the title page, it said, Old Receipts from O. St. John's. Well, I knew that it was St. John's, Berkeley County, South Carolina, a few miles down the road from where I grew up. And so I took the book and I showed it to Karen Hess, and she helped me very specifically date it. And so for the next 7-8 years, I dove into plantation journals and market records and printed cookbooks. So that's how it began.
Back in that time in Charleston, what was the general culinary condition like?
When I opened my store in 1986, as far as restaurants go, there were a couple of French places. There were a couple of Italian places. There was the place we called the Greasy Greek. And there were a couple of self-proclaimed soul food houses that sold maybe red rice and fried fish, but there was no urban farmers market. There were none of these dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of restaurants that you now read about in Condé Nast Traveler, for example. It was basically a culinary backwater.
So in essence, then, you sort of helped Charlestonians discover or rediscover their own food.
Yes, I did. There was an alternative newspaper, a monthly newspaper in Charleston, and I had a column in it. And basically, the book, which came out in 1992, basically the book was a collection of expanded articles of mine that I tried out on the public. I also, when I got back to Charleston, I couldn't find stone ground, whole grain, grits, or cornmeal anywhere. Oh, that's not quite true. You could maybe find a bag on the shelf of a natural food store, health food store, whatever you want to call it. No milling date, sitting out, not refrigerated, and whole grains go bad quickly, especially in hot and humid Charleston and New Orleans. So I set out on a mission to find someone growing the right type of corn, grinding it the right way, letting it dry in the field, processing the right way, grinding it between stones, not adding anything to or taking anything away from it. And I visited 30 mills throughout Appalachia, trying to find someone doing it right, and I found this young couple who had just left desk jobs in Atlanta, and they had restored an old mill, and they were growing the corn themselves at the time. They had about 7 acres, and grinding it right, and it was the right kind of corn treated the right way, and so I started selling grits.
So these grits, they tasted like the grits of your childhood.
They taste like, I love when, yes, it's the traditional corn, it's dent corn, and there are several kinds. There's flint corn because it's very, very hard,
yeah.
And dent corn, the kernel has a dent in the top of it. They sort of look like teeth, and I started selling them in my shop and writing about it. I profiled my millers in the New York Times. I wrote about it in Gourmet. Gradually, chefs and restaurateurs started buying grits and putting them on their menu in Charleston. And by the time the book came out, 6 years after I opened the store, I had grits customers in all 50 states, many of whom are restaurateurs and or chefs, few of whom are actually in the South, and almost none of whom are actually Southerners. So of that, I'm most proud, really. There wasn't a single restaurant serving shrimp and grits in Charleston when I moved home in 86. And
that's
you dare not have it on your menu now.
So I guess that it's all your fault that I constantly have to explain to people today that shrimp and grits is not Creole food.
Well, it is Creole food, but it's Creole with a small C. It's not Louisiana Creole because, you know, Creole means a mashup. and Charleston had a Creole cuisine develop, you know, it was founded 50 years before New Orleans. By 1750, almost all of the people, both black and white, who lived in Charleston had first lived in the West Indies. So we did have a Creole culture and a Creole cooking. It's just not Louisiana Creole with a capital C. So,
well, from where you sit, what do you think the most amazing thing is as you look at the changes that have been affected by this work that you did over 20 years ago?
I really don't think that I affected the changes. I think that I'm part. I can see this.
You're the agent of change.
Well, I see this sweeping arc, really. But I really think it begins much farther back. I think it began in the 1960s when Fritz Hollings was a very forward-looking governor, was elected governor, and he saw the state suffering from poverty, and he did many things to help the tourist industry. With Fritz, the interstate highway system came, so all these people could get there, and air conditioning came. So there's your beginning. And then the 80s came, and this great, you know, economic boom of the 80s, however it may have been based on fake ideas. I mean, it's like, but it came, and there was suddenly all of this money, and people were spending money to go out to eat, and they're coming to town, and restaurants are opening, and so as people started putting shrimp and grits on their menu, then it started spreading throughout the country. So yes, my work is important, I think. I think a university press wouldn't be republishing the book if they didn't think it were important enough to keep the book in print. But I can't take too much credit. I'm not a chef. The first time somebody asked me to hold the sauce, I'd slap them. So, you know.
Well, tell me what is special and different about cooking your grits than what people might be accustomed to.
Well, they are whole grain. Nothing has been taken away from them and nothing has been added to them. So we haven't degerminated them. And degerminating is a technical term for removing the germ. And the germ is the part up at the top that is also known as the kernel. And it has a hard casing on it that encases the oil. So we don't remove that. It can be removed several ways. It's mostly removed mechanically, but it can be removed by putting grits in a lye bath also. And then they're called hominy grits because it becomes hominy then. So it's not removed. And because it's not removed, that fat is in there. And we all know that fat carries flavor. So to begin with, they're more delicious. But you've also got to cook them longer because there's more stuff to break down.
Mm-hmm.
So they haven't been broken down. Commercial grits that you buy in the grocery store, they'll last on the shelf forever, but they taste like the packaging they're they're packed in. Yeah, they taste like cardboard, and there's no oil there, and there's not much of anything. Furthermore, because of the steel rollers they've been ground between, the steel rollers heat up, and they've actually been cooked a little bit. I like to cook them in the crock pot. Overnight, you put it on low, 4 parts water to 1 part grits. A little bit of salt. Always salt your grits in the beginning because if you don't, it's really hard to salt grits afterwards. And I just let them go overnight, and they're usually perfect. Interestingly, when I cook grits, I only use water and salt. And when people taste them, they can't believe it. I've had chefs here in New Orleans taste them and say, I can't believe there's not butter, milk, or cream in there. And I treat grits as one would treat rice or pasta. I want it to be the starch. I want it to taste like corn. I want it to taste like what it is. And then you can put anything you want to in the sauce. Yeah, I don't put butter in my grits or cream or milk in my grits, but I may have 3 sticks in the sauce. So, you know.
Well, and as opposed to that steel rolling method of making the grits, describe what stone grinding really is.
We have 2 blue granite stones. Actually, we have lots of them because my millers are fanatical artisans. And you have 2 stones, and they are going in opposite directions in the mill, and you put the corn between the stones. Unlike 90% of the millers in the country, we do not bolt our products. Bolting is a type of sifting. And most people will sell you what they call whole grain grits. And then they will sift out the smaller particles and sell that as corn flour, what you call fish fry here in Louisiana, or corn meal. We don't do that. My millers are such perfectionists that for the corn flour, we put the stones almost touching. And we grind it very finely. Everything goes in the bag. For the cornmeal, we pull the stones apart a little bit and grind. We have a medium grind. Everything goes in the bag. Same thing with the grits. Pull the stones a little bit farther apart. Everything goes in the bag. Most cornmeals and corn flours you buy, even if they say they're stone ground whole grain, they aren't really whole grain. And the reason they're not whole grain is because they've been bolted. And back to the germ, it's the hardest part of the corn. And those little flecks, those hard flecks that you see in there, they're harder to grind. And so you're getting only the other part, the starchy part, and not the parts with all the flavor.
Well, you mentioned fish fry, and I would be remiss letting you get out of here without having a word about deep fat frying, because I understand that's another passion of yours.
I wrote a book called The Fearless Frying Cookbook. Yes, it is. You know, frying is, it always cracks me up when you start talking about frying, because people will say these truly uninformed things, such as, oh, I can't eat those French fries because I've got a problem with my cholesterol. No, wait a second. Okay, you've got a problem with cholesterol. Never mind that they've never proved that ingested cholesterol has a thing to do with serum cholesterol. If you're really worried about your cholesterol, you better choose your grandparents. I mean, it's the truth. It's the truth. And so I'm thinking, okay, you can't eat my fries. Peanut oil doesn't have any cholesterol, so what's the deal? Frying has a bad rap. It's a mess to fry, but you know what? Cooking is messing. They're potato peels. They're, you know, there's banana skins. There's, you know, you throw away a lot of stuff. It's a mess. If you think about it, deep frying is actually a dry cooking method. Mm-hmm. Water boils at 212 degrees. I fry almost everything in peanut oil because it's very stable and it has a very high flash point. That is a point where it will burst into flames and where it will disintegrate. So I fry almost everything at 365 degrees, which is very easy to remember because of the days of the year. First thing people should do if they want to fry is buy a thermometer. Check it with your boiling water. So you're putting food in 365 degree oil, and you hear, shh. Well, what is that? That is the water in the food being sucked out and immediately vaporized. Mm-hmm. So as long as steam is coming out, fat can't go in. So it's really a dry cooking technique. Clean oil, always clean oil. Don't crowd your pot. Constantly maintain the temperature. I think one of the mistakes that many people do is they turn their burner up all the way to the highest setting. It comes up to 365. They say, oh, it's 365. So then they put the food in, and they start dropping all the food in, all the pieces of fish. I put one piece of food in at 12 o'clock. I put in the next piece of food at 3 o'clock, going around the circle. I constantly mind, you don't crowd the pot. You take the food out in the order it was put in. You use tongs. You lift the food out of each piece of the food, and you let all the excess grease or oil drip off of the piece that you're frying, and then you put it on wire racks, not down on paper towels or in paper bags where it's just going to reabsorb the grease. Cooking, you have to watch what you're doing. You've got hot oil, you've got boiling water, you've got...
And it's dangerous, but you know the craziest thing? In cooking class, the people who, for some reason, think the way you test the temperature of oil is to put a drop of water in it. Is that the most frightening thing?
It's absolutely crazy. You can test oil if you don't have a thermometer with a little cube of bread, fresh bread. Basically, it will brown perfectly in about a minute if the oil's at the right temperature. But water's just going to instantly vaporize and splash oil up all over you.
Yeah, well, I hope anybody who has that thought in their head, we've dispelled it. And I am so grateful that you made the time to come for this visit. Come back and see us.
I sure will.
John Martin Taylor and Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking. When we come back from a short break, we'll meet this week's culinary heritage hero. He's part of a legendary baking family who single-handedly turns out over 60,000 king cakes a year. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. Baking has been a family tradition that spans over three generations for this week's clan of culinary heritage heroes. From a small 24-hour-a-day drive-up window business begun in 1959, this family bakery grew into a full-service operation, especially renowned for their king cakes.
It's flour, it's water, it's yeast, it's flavoring, and it mixes for 20 minutes or so, and then, you know, it sets, and we let the yeast rise, we scale the dough off, we flatten it out on the table, we still put the cinnamon, sugar, and the oil on by hand, we hand braid every king cake, it goes into the proof house where the dough rises again, goes into the oven, and then goes for decorating with the icing and sugar and all that good stuff.
Our heritage heroes bake over 60,000 king cakes annually, spreading our Louisiana tradition across the world, shipping them fresh daily to hungry king cake lovers everywhere.
International shipping has grown. A lot of people, you know, they have friends that live overseas and they want them to have a king cake. It's basically wherever UPS will go. So we've sent them to Egypt, Sweden, lots to France, lots to London. And then with a lot of the soldiers serving overseas, you know, families will pack them up and get all the air out the bag and ship them over there. When my cousin was serving in Iraq, he said it took about 2 weeks to get it, but he said it was a lot better than anything else they were eating. So,
On September 22, 2010, our heroes broke the Guinness Book record for the world's largest king cake, baking and assembling a cake that circled the Superdome. Our heroes sold slices of that record-breaking cake for charity, resulting in a donation which exceeded $47,000 in that single day.
It was actually two king cakes. We were going to have one king cake that kind of looped over itself and would have been about 8,000 pounds. But the Guinness folks said, nope, you can't loop it over itself. It has to be a scaled-up version of the real thing. So we said, well, can we break two records? And they said, yeah, sure, no problem. But the two cakes totaled right around 8,000 pounds together. But we broke the old record by like 1,000 pounds. So we did it up big.
That's why the Haydell Family Bakery is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations to the Haydell family. King cake season begins on Twelfth Night, January 6th, so get ready to eat your fill of one of Louisiana's most delicious culinary traditions. There's no disputing the fact that Haydell's Bakery King Cake is real Louisiana Eats. Seattle-based attorney Paul Swanson specializes in litigation surrounding the food, beverage, and hospitality industries, and as such serves as the firm Lane Powell's food law reporter, contributing to their site, Earth and Table. Paul, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. It's great to be here. I'm really enjoying my time in New Orleans.
Well, I would like you to tell everybody about your day job. What is it that you do for Lane Powell's law firm?
I'm what's called an intellectual property litigator. And so what I do is all of the dispute side of issues that come up in either patents, trademarks, copyrights, or trade secrets, which are considered the four main classic areas of intellectual property law.
And how did you develop into becoming their food law reporter?
Well, it's kind of a funny story because I actually got into cooking, and believe me, if I can cook, anybody can cook, because I started at a very base level. But I got very much into wanting to learn how to cook myself, and part of that was to escape from what I call my law head. I wanted to do something tangible with my hands that actually produced something instead of just hot air and arguments. And so I got into food back in the 90s by taking a lot of cooking classes. But as life went on in my practice, I ended up with cases that really came out of the agricultural world that involved plant patents and trademarks. And that has just grown over time to the point where I now spend all of my time in intellectual property litigation, and a significant portion of my practice is related to food and agriculture.
I'd like you to tell us about some of the various topics that you cover on the blog.
Well, I was out researching. I wanted to see what were some of the newest developments in patent law. That's fairly easy to do. I wanted to see if there was anything new in the food world. And so the food law reporter is more designed to look at what's happening at the intellectual property level of food and agriculture, as opposed to looking at food safety issues, for example. That is a whole nother area, and there's some very good attorneys that work on that, including Bill Marler, who's from Seattle, who really was the first person to really make a name as a food law safety guru expert.
So food production, what sort of patents would people be getting in food production?
Well, like most patents, you're probably going to see more patents being issued to companies that have an incentive to try and get to the next cutting level of technology that will give them some efficiency, some breakthrough that has some practical utility in their operations. And so that's where you're seeing a number of the food processing patents are fairly big business, because anytime you can, you know, get that canning line going better, some different process for cutting meat, some different process for processing food through a restaurant. Those are all potentially patentable subject matter areas.
Tell me how patents are enforced, patents like a food patent.
Patents are basically what a patent does is gives you a right to exclude others from practicing your invention. So there's no requirement that you actually have to make what you patented. Your right is to exclude others, which if you start to think about it, makes sense. A lot of inventors, if they're solo inventors without financing, they may not be able to build what they created and invented, but they can prevent others from doing it. And so it's a way of getting licensing revenue. There's pejoratively a lot of plant patent owners now are considered, trolls who may not practice the invention, but they've amassed, patent rights. That's really our system, and it's meant to allow licensing of patents to happen. And so rather than trolls, I guess my preferred terminology is non-practicing entities, NPEs.
And give me an example of what sort of problem that creates.
Well, it's a way to monetize patents. So I don't think it creates problems other than if you're practicing the invention and you don't want to pay either a license fee or do what it takes to get the rights validly.
Well, getting ready to talk to you today, I did some research on the blog, and one of the topics that I'm particularly curious about is the recent patent work that involves acoustic sound and taste alchemy. Okay, now what's that about?
In one of my recent articles, I wanted to just look and see what is coming out of the USPTO, the United States Patent and Trademark Office, which issues patents. I wanted to see some of the latest patents that had come out. And one that caught my eye was one that had a method for improving the taste of food through acoustic sounds. And it basically talked about putting a sonic transducer into liquid and then putting whatever food that you wanted to have its taste improved near it and then operating this transducer. And based on the patent and what it said it improved the taste for the people that were testing it. And I'm skeptical of that connection. I'm not sure. It doesn't explain how it actually does that. And it raised kind of a central point to patenting is that you don't necessarily need scientific validity in order to gain a patent, to get a patent issued in the United States.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's very interesting. What were some of the specific cases that he cited where there was a change in taste?
Apparently, he did some taste tests. You don't get any of the methodology of the taste tests that he did. And he didn't have to tell you how he got to his conclusions. He does tell you how to enable the invention, which is one of the requirements for getting a patent in the United States. But he doesn't give you the background. I thought it was interesting, though, because I think sound and its impact on taste is something that's underappreciated yet and not well understood.
Well, do you think it was background sound that was somehow affecting the taster's taste?
They were tasting a number of different things. They worked with wine. They worked with Perrier water, milk, orange juice, fruits. So I guess you could take some two-buck chuck or something, and if you said the right things over a long enough period of time, preferably around 30 minutes, maybe it would improve the taste. I think it actually demonstrates something more, and that's the power of suggestion, the power of emotion, the power of mood in taste.
And how those things can affect taste.
Right. And there's a lot of research going on in that. And, even in airplane food, at that high level, there are certain tastes that are harder to taste when you're in a plane. Or if you have certain noise, some of it can mask certain tastes. I don't understand it, from a scientific standpoint, but people are trying to get their head and arms and everything else wrapped around that idea and see where it goes.
Amazing. Well, I have just found this whole conversation so so fascinating. And I really hope you'll come back and keep us abreast of what's happening in the food hospitality world of law.
It was great being here, Poppy.
Thanks, Paul. Attorney Paul Swanson, practicing law from an edible point of view. Mans is our Baton Rouge-based Louisiana Eats roving reporter. He's a food fanatic who's always on the hunt for fascinating new food stories just for us. So, Frank, what do you have for us today?
Well, hello, Poppy. I was recently lucky enough to get a tour of a third-generation rice mill over near Crowley that produces Cajun country rice, which is a medium-grain rice grown here in Louisiana. But just an interesting experience to see their facility. As I said, it was third-generation production facility. It's almost this sort of Rube Goldberg sort of setup with gears and pulleys and belts whizzing around everywhere, and the air's sort of heavy with the dust of rice husks. And you just realize how close to the production and the growing of our food that was such a staple here, like medium grain rice that shows up in so many dishes, that how closely interrelated that is to the communities around here and how little it's changed in a lot of ways over the years.
Well, Frank, who are these people? What did you learn about these rice production folks?
Well, the farmer who I spent some time with farms about 1,500 acres, and as I said, he's fourth generation and lives in a house that was built by his grandfather. So you really get a sense of how dedicated these families are to these traditional modes of production. And even though they've obviously modernized over time, you know, when I was out with the farmer in his field and we were harvesting rice, you know, we're in an air-conditioned new piece of farming equipment. And, you know, it's air conditioned. It has a DVD player. It's got this readout that's showing, you know, the amount of moisture that's in the rice that's coming in and how many bushels per acre you're getting. So it's just interesting to see the way that those people have adapted over time to traditions that have been in their family for multiple generations, but that they've then leveraged technology to keep that business going.
Frank, if this area in Crowley had once had all of those processors right there on the road, and now they're down to three, did you get the sense that this is something endangered?
I think that small-scale agriculture is in danger everywhere. And, you know, it might be doing them a slight disservice to call it small-scale agriculture, but let's say medium-scale agriculture. You know, it's just hard to compete with big multinational companies or with producers who have lower cost of labor and less restrictive environmental regulations in other countries. So you have this Louisiana-grown product that's going up against products that are made in parts of the world where the cost of doing business is a lot less expensive, which, I, you know, is going to put any business on a somewhat precarious footing. Things can change overnight, but they seem to be doing pretty well, and particularly now that a lot of rice farmers have gone over to using their fields as crawfish fields whenever the rice isn't growing. They've managed to pull two or three crops a season or a year out of the same piece of ground, which changes the economics considerably.
That sounds like a great field trip, and I want to thank you so much for taking us out to Crowley and
sure.
telling us about that Louisiana rice industry. It's an important part of our state's culture.
Sure, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank McManus. If caviar was part of your New Year's Eve celebration, you might be surprised to learn that it may have been made right here in Louisiana. We've got the skinny for you on those salty, delicious eggs when we come right back. When you were mine. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Caviar. Just the word brings thoughts of the extravagant and exotic. After all, caviar was once reserved strictly for royalty. Historically, the finest caviar has always been thought to originate in Russia. John Burke, owner and founder of the Louisiana Caviar Company, is here to change forever your perception of this very special food. John, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, thank you, Poppy. Are you ready for some caviar?
I'm always ready for some caviar.
Well, 'tis the season for caviar and champagne.
So tell me, Louisiana caviar, what is it?
Well, our Louisiana caviar comes from a prehistoric fish found abundantly in the swamps of Louisiana. It's a freshwater fish, and we harvest all of ours from the Atchafalaya Basin. It's a 200-million-year-old species of fish, and it's in the same class as sturgeon and paddlefish, which are your traditional caviar-producing species. And Cajuns call it a shoe pick.
How does that Louisiana caviar really compare to the gold standard Russian caviar?
Well, for American palates, they really prefer our American caviar and our Louisiana caviar because it's less fishy and less salty tasting than traditional Russian caviars. So to talk to some chefs, it is better than the Russian caviar, yet our price is about one-tenth of the price of the Russian caviar.
Well, that's pretty terrific news. So how did you start this business?
Actually, it was a little Cajun couple that had discovered that when they applied a caviar process to the roe of the shoe pick, it turned black. It starts off kind of a steel gray color. And I was working with my mother in some economic development, getting a nice house built for the Atchafalaya River in Morgan City. And through that, I met this couple, and it looked like caviar, and it tastes like caviar, but who was going to eat caviar from a shoe pick? It's considered a trash fish at that time. So I sent some samples to New York and to Dallas, and I got these phone calls back. Sure, we'll take 10,000 pounds. Okay, we'll take 5,000 pounds. I was like, oh, my goodness, I guess we're going into the caviar business.
Congratulations. Talk about break out the caviar and champagne. Now, take us through the whole process, starting in the Atchafalaya Basin all the way right through that mother-of-pearl caviar spoon.
All right. From the Atchafalaya swamps to Commander's Palace. Here we go. We have commercial fishermen that'll go out and capture these fish, and we really target just the females because you can tell a male from a female. And then we'll bring them back to our processing plant, and we extract the roe and separate the eggs from the fatty tissue and add salt. Then you have caviar. It really matures quite quickly, overnight almost, within a day. And then we can deliver it to the finest restaurants in the world, in my opinion. John Besh's restaurants, Commander's Palace, Ritz-Carlton's, and away it goes.
John, you mentioned Commander's Palace. Actually, I think I saw you on the Food Network with your caviar and Tori McPhail. Tell us how that happened.
Oh, that was a really fun program. Adam Gertler, host of the show, came down. We put him in a boat, had him go and set nets and make his own caviar. And then I brought it to Commander's Palace and had Tori serve him caviar that he had just made the day before. Oh, and Tori's dish was just divine. I mean, they have their homemade creme fraiche. He took a quail egg and poached it in crab boil and then topped it with caviar and just brought it out to people at the chef's table and in the main dining room. And everybody just fell out at how good this caviar was. Just thinking back to it makes my mouth water. I mean, our product has been on the menu at Commander's Palace now for over 20 years. So I've known Commander's has known me since Emerald was a chef there.
Wow. Well, I heard a little something about a new product that I think you started last year, Ghost Pepper Caviar.
Oh, this has wowed everybody. Everybody who tried it could not believe how delicious this combination was of having a little bit of ghost pepper infused into the caviar and how it excites your palate without having to run for the milk carton. And on a Scoville scale of how hot stuff is, a habanero comes in at about 5,000 units, and a ghost pepper comes in at 1,000,000.
Oh, yikes.
So we take just a tiny little bit so that it does just excite your palate and without the burn. But kind of the salt and peppery together and caviar. People who say, oh, I don't like caviar, have tried this product and just say, I've never had anything like this. This is really good.
So do you have a favorite way to eat your caviar, John?
Of course I do, Poppy. My favorite way is caviar body shots.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
no.
Where you can just get pure caviar. Would you like to try some now?
Let's
you
want to
show me a little body part and we can have some?
Well, how about this body part? Will that
one do? Oh, that looks divine. Yes, indeed.
Mmm. Well, if that isn't just tailor-made for Louisiana tastes, it's got like the spiciness of seafood boil. It's got the salt of the sea. It's delicious.
The cold seafood flavor.
It's
so shiny.
Wonderful.
These eggs are just beautiful.
Well, I love that body shot idea. Good
Isn't
job, John.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Nice, simple way to eat your caviar.
Thank you so much for helping us celebrate New Year's in such an exciting way.
Yeah, Happy New Year's.
John Burke of the Louisiana Caviar Company.
And cheers.
This is Louisiana Eats. Jody Brown, the kitchen commando, uses food as her first line of defense against the many diseases plaguing us today. High blood pressure, diabetes, diverticulitis, even cancer can often be averted through nutrition. And as serious as this all sounds, Jody makes it fun. Jody, how'd you go down this path?
Well, actually, this path started for me post-Katrina. When I spent 2 years here after the storm, and I was pretty polluted by the time it was all over, said and done with, and I decided to leave New Orleans for a while. I went on to my hometown of Boston and met with an acupuncturist friend of mine who brought me over to a new food lifestyle where I actually went on a cleanse, started feeling better, lost weight, and have been following this lifestyle since.
Well, at this time of year, everybody undoubtedly is concerned about that little extra holiday weight.
Mm-hmm.
Where should people begin?
Well, I first of all will tell you, have what you want. I don't believe in all or nothing. I think that you have to reward yourself. They don't call it soul food for nothing, Miss Poppy. But you have to have a little bit of what you do want. But if you want to start to swing your life over in the other direction so that you can treat yourself occasionally, start with green smoothies in the morning, which are a combination of fruits and vegetables that are put in the blender and pureed, and you can have that instead of your sugar-laden breakfast, and a salad. If I can get people to have a smoothie and a salad every day, you will be on the fast track to swinging your life in the other direction.
Well, shopping, prepping, and organizing has a lot to do with this too, doesn't it?
It sure does. That's sort of where my forte comes into staying in charge of the successes that you want with your diet. We have to set ourselves up so that every time we open the fridge, you have success for what you're trying to do. So shopping comes with it. One of the things that's a key element for shopping appropriately for healthier foods is perimeter shopping in the supermarket. The things that are along the outside walls have a tendency to be less processed and better for you. When you get into the middle of the supermarket, that can be problematic. But bringing the things home and spending an hour and a half or 2 hours at the front of the week making some salads, prepping some things, and putting them in the fridge ready to use so that when you come home at night on a Wednesday, all you need is 20 minutes to throw some stuff together and you have a meal.
Well, I'm one of those people who was never a bunny in a former life, and I'm not so good with the green salad thing. Anybody who knows me knows I'm bad like that. But I think I'm hearing that you're not just talking about tossed salads.
No, I'm not. There's a variety of different things that you can do with a variety of different greens. For people who aren't necessarily warm and fuzzy about greens, I think that they have an old vision of what greens are. The iceberg lettuce, which is not very exciting unless you put a ton of blue cheese dressing and some bacon bits on it. There's a lot of things out there for the consumer that are much more welcoming to the palate. And they make it very easy for us with greens right now. You can buy them all washed and ready in the supermarket. You can saute up some arugula, which we like bold flavors here. That's something that goes a long way. It's just another example of something that goes a long way in the salad department.
So let's look in that refrigerator and know that you've got a hungry person who's going to make a bad choice unless there's something good in there. What do you want us to see when we open up that door? Give me some concrete examples.
Well, some concrete examples are some of the healthy chocolates that I make. That's a great way to take care of that Jones that you're having. I make chocolates out of coconut oil, which is incredibly nutrient dense, cacao, which is the most antioxidant rich food on the planet. Now, cacao is the raw form of cocoa. It hasn't been heated, so it still has a lot of the nutritional value in it. And honey and nuts, raw nuts. If you take raw nuts and combine them with these ingredients, you can make some delicious chocolates that will satisfy that sweet thing. So that you have to have a reward in the fridge always. First, something sweet, but then maybe a salad, a cold grain salad, like a quinoa salad instead of a pasta salad, some hummus that you make from scratch. I put a lot of very bold flavors in my hummus. You can take a leaf of romaine lettuce, slather it with some hummus, and put a couple of dollops of quinoa salad in it and have a snack. So setting yourself up with things that you have a couple of different options built into the front of the week allows you to have success with fill in your gut when you open the fridge.
Now, is this a raw diet that you're advocating?
No, I don't advocate a completely raw diet. But what I do tell people is that they need to get more raw fruits and vegetables into their life. So in the almost 50 years I've been on the planet, I've seen a lot of fad diets come and go in my lifetime. But the one thing they have not told us to change, they actually keep telling us to increase, is we need more fresh fruits and vegetables in our diet in order to stay healthy. And the reason that is because when you don't heat food, you get the maximum nutrition available. So what I am suggesting is that not that you go raw, but that you incorporate more raw fresh fruits and vegetables and nuts and grains and legumes and seeds into your diet rather than stuff that the life has been cooked out of it.
And a lot of people regard fat as the enemy, but you disagree, don't you?
No. Fat is flavor. Come on. We've been cooking for years. That's where the flavor is. And again, it's choosing the right fats. Plant-based fats are loaded with all sorts of great nutrition that the body needs. Avocados, nuts, seeds are incredibly rich in plant-based fats that the body treats and flushes out differently than it does the saturated fats.
So with all of these good, healthy thoughts, you actually encourage people to cheat, don't you?
I do. But I believe that, especially in a city where the food culture is so rich, that you cannot be in this environment and not want to imbibe in things that aren't so great for you. So here's my suggestion. If Ben and Jerry are going to knock at your door, you let them in. But you turn the TV off or you sit down with somebody and you enjoy the food. You don't, you know, get in front of the TV screen or the laptop and not be cognizant of what you're doing. Indulge yourself in it.
Mindless eating is a very bad thing.
Right.
It's not fair to the food and it's not fair to you.
I couldn't agree more. So yes, cheat. Just do it less frequently. But when you do it right so that you really get your bang for the buck.
And what about eating out?
I eat out. I eat out very frequently. I'm getting better at picking and choosing things off the menu that are better choices for me. But there are times, I'm not going to lie to you, when the pork chop is in front of me and girlfriend loads up and gets some mashed potatoes and gravy to go with it. I live in a real world. And I know that in order to not become a social pariah, especially in a city like this, that sometimes I'm going to step outside the box. So I eat really well at home, so that when I go out, I can put on the feed bag and really enjoy myself.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and sharing this exciting philosophy with the Louisiana Eats listeners.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for having me, Miss Poppy.
Jody Brown, the Kitchen Commando. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.